Hi, welcome to On Jordan, a podcast on Jordanian politics featuring interviews with experts on the Hashemite Kingdom. My name is Aaron Magid, a former Amman-based journalist, now in Washington. While this podcast was focused on modern-day Jordanian politics, I wanted to make an exception for one particularly critical moment in the kingdom's history, Jordan's 1970 to 1971 civil war. King Hussein eventually emerged victorious, driving out Palestinian guerrilla organizations from Jordan, but it came with a heavy cost. Thousands were killed in the fighting between Jordanian security forces and Palestinian militants some 50 years ago. Yet it's a conflict that's still not well understood to this day. For a deep dive on Jordan's civil war, it's great to welcome Dr. Yazid Sayer to the podcast. Dr. Sayer is a senior fellow at the Carnegie Middle East Center. He's the author of Armed Struggle and the Search for State, the Palestinian National Movement. Dr. Sayer previously served as professor at the King's College in London. So Dr. Sayer, what was the origin of Jordan's 1970 civil war?
The emergence of an autonomous Palestinian national liberation movement, an armed movement, after the June 1967 war between Israel and the Arab states, produced a direct challenge to the Jordanian authorities and the monarchy in particular of King Hussein and the Hashemite family, because Jordan had already absorbed significant numbers of Palestinians over the decades. So when the autonomous Palestinian movement emerged and called for waging a war of liberation against Israel, and started to recruit and mobilize and raise funds and undertake other activities in Jordan, the authorities were troubled by this. Palestinian military activity against Israel drew Israeli reprisals on Jordanian targets and damaged the economy, inflicting casualties and so on. But additionally, the Palestinian movement was mobilizing classes, people who were poor, refugees, and at times also parts of the middle class in the main cities and in some of the native Jordanian villages and towns. This was seen by the monarchy as potentially threatening to its grip on power. And so there were numerous efforts between 1967 and 1970, when civil war broke out fully, to make the Palestinian movement accept certain limitations on its freedom of recruiting and movement and its freedom of operating from Jordanian territory against Israeli targets. These efforts to contain and constrain Palestinian activity, of course, were rejected by the Palestinian movement, which was still on the rise, still sorting out its own politics, not inclined to agree any kind of compromise that would limit its ability to fight Israel or to be an independent actor. So this then led to clashes on repeated occasions between the two sides, between the Jordanian army in particular and various Palestinian guerrilla groups. This would then be followed by a new agreement, and then would be followed by violations or mutual accusations, until finally everything fell apart in September 1970, when King Hussein came to the conclusion that there was no coexistence and no meaningful sovereignty as long as the Palestinian movement was able to enjoy pretty much unfettered freedom.
Moving forward to 1970, Palestinian militants took multiple civilian airplanes hostage and landed them in Jordan. Can you clarify what happened here?
The incident in which members of the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, these members hijacked four civilian passenger aircraft from around the world to a makeshift airstrip in the Jordanian desert in early September 1970. And this was intended to be a challenge to the government and to defy its calls for bringing the Palestinian movement to heel. However, this was just the last straw. There had been numerous incidents in the past which had soured relations between the two sides, and to some extent had also alienated not only what are known as the native Jordanians, i.e. people who were originally from areas on the east bank of the River Jordan. There were events and activities by the Palestinian guerrilla groups that had alienated large parts also even of the Palestinian middle class, which started to feel threatened. Daily experience of armed militiamen or guerrillas belonging to Palestinian factions roaming around the streets of the cities in unlicensed vehicles with their guns and weapons, at times setting up checkpoints or roadblocks, seeking donations, various activities that diminished the impression that there was a sovereign government in the country, and also left the Jordanian army and the police and other security agencies feeling weakened and prevented from carrying out their responsibilities. So how much of these perceptions were genuine, how much were contrived, how much was avoidable, it's difficult to say maybe, but certainly the Palestinian movement was poorly disciplined, itself was full of factional rivalries, and this fed into the atmosphere of unaccountability. There were two or three years of development of this kind of tense relationship that on the eve of the civil war in 1970 had left the Palestinian movement, the PLO, already losing the goodwill of significant sectors, both of its own fellow Palestinians in the kingdom, but also even of a number of Jordanians who might otherwise have been more positive or neutral towards it, but who at the last minute decided to side with the king against the Palestinian movement. So the hijacking of the airplanes in September 1970, it was the last straw, and it was it played into the king's hands because it was such a blatantly open challenge to the king's authority and the government's authority that it both gave the pretext and also maybe helped motivate a sharper, fiercer onslaught by the Jordanian army than otherwise might have happened.
During the most intense 1970 clashes, where did the fighting take place in Jordan?
The main battlefield was the capital, Amman itself, and the battle took place initially on some of the outskirts as Jordanian army columns entered from several sides. But the toughest fighting was in central areas, not too far from the royal palace in downtown Amman, around the middle class, mainly Palestinian neighborhood of Al-Waibdi and others, and of course around the main refugee camps such as Wahdat and Al-Hussein, where there was the toughest resistance and where the army tried to cut off and isolate different pockets of Palestinian armed groups. Overall, casualty tally was something on the order of 3,500 to maybe 5,000 dead, say 3,500 civilians, possibly with about 1,500 military dead from both sides. The PLO leader Yasser Arafat later inflated this figure several times. Every time he spoke about the civil war, he ended up basically claiming 25,000 dead, although Palestinian figures from that period, the Red Crescent Society, for instance, which collected the dead and the wounded, indicated figures of, as I said, 3,500 to 5,000 dead.
When you mentioned 3,500 to 5,000 killed, which cited the greatest number of casualties?
Many families were, you know, are mixed. I mean, if you think of Jordanian and Palestinian as being sort of distinct ethnicities, then a great many families are a mixture of both. And so I think that, you know, assigning a casualty to one side or the other is problematic. Beyond that, the side with the largest amount of armor and artillery was the Jordanian army, which used it to shell neighborhoods and refugee camps which were held by the PLO. And so it seems pretty evident that regardless of what their ethnicity or nationality was, that most casualties occurred in areas under PLO control due to army shelling and tank fire. In terms of military casualties, there were probably more on the Palestinian side because training was poor, armament was light, coordination was poor, and the army had the upper hand in this respect. But the army did also suffer the defection of around 5,000 officers and soldiers, whether because they sympathized with the Palestinian movement or were anti-monarchic, or because they were of Palestinian background themselves. This wasn't enough to fundamentally weaken the army or stop its offensive, but it was nonetheless significant that around 5,000 men did defect in the course of the fighting or soon after.
And why did Syria invade northern Jordan in 1970?
Syria was at the tail end of a power struggle between two wings of the ruling Ba'ath Party, the so-called Arab Socialist Renaissance Party. One wing was headed by people regarded as the more radical left wing of the party, best represented by the president Nur al-Din Atassi, but more importantly by a senior officer and member of the leading junta that had taken power in the country in 1966. This man was Salah Jadid. But on the other side was someone who's even more powerful. This was Defense Minister and Air Force Commander Hafez al-Assad, who eventually took power in November 1970 from the other wing, put them all in prison or in exile. And so what happened in Jordan during the civil war is that the more radical wing of the Ba'ath Party in Syria, which had at least officially adopted the Palestine cause and the Palestine movement and its call for the total liberation of Palestine through people's war, sort of, if you like, Maoist ideas of guerrilla war and people's war. Whether they were genuinely committed to this or not is debatable, but they used this issue in their internal maneuvering to isolate and weaken their rivals within the Ba'ath Party and in particular Hafez al-Assad. When the civil war started, the Syrian regime at the time, alongside the Iraqi regime in which Saddam Hussein was then deputy head, both regimes pledged to assist the Palestinian movement against what they saw as a reactionary monarchy and a pro-American monarchy. But in fact, the Iraqis didn't intervene, although they had 15,000 troops already inside the country to help defend it from Israel. They actually did nothing. And what was interesting was that the only military intervention came from Syria when the wing in the government and in the military, headed by Salah Jadid, ordered a column of tanks, maybe 200 tanks, it's unclear if that, or 200 armored vehicles, or over the border into northern Jordan. But because Hafez Assad commanded the air force and was opposed to all this, he refused to provide air cover. And so both the USA and Israel let the Jordanians know that they might intervene against the Syrian armor. But in the event, the Jordanian Air Force was able to take to the sky without worry about clashing with the Syrian Air Force and did a lot of damage to the Syrian vehicles and forced them to withdraw alongside also Jordanian armor units. So in other words, the Syrian intervention was half-hearted and was handicapped from the outset because of this internal struggle within Syria. And Hafez al-Assad then used this whole debacle as ammunition against his rivals, and in the following month or two, maneuvered against them, expelled them from their positions in the party and in the military, and then took complete power to himself.
Beyond the US warning, did Washington have any other tangible involvement in the crisis?
I'm not aware of any other activity, and I don't remember anymore whether the warning was issued publicly, but we do know from sources that were leaked at the time or soon after that there were private communications with Jordan, and I believe Israeli messages were relayed, probably, if I recall correctly, Israeli messages were relayed via US channels. Basically, the gist of this was that they weren't going to sit by if the Syrians seemed to be tipping the balance and the monarchy was in danger of collapsing.
Okay, interesting. Now, you mentioned that there were around 3,000 to 5,000 people who were killed during the war. How much support did King Hussein have among Jordanian for this pretty large crackdown?
A lot of people who had started out very sympathetic to the Palestinian movement. I don't mean just sympathetic to Palestine and the Palestinians, because I think that could be said of pretty much everyone in the country, including the king, I think, quite genuinely. They'd all seen a fellow Arab society with which they had very extensive, very, you know, centuries-old social relations, trade relations, labor and investment that moved back and forth between the East Bank and the West Bank of Palestine and Jordan. These borders didn't even exist, you know, just a century ago under the Ottomans. This was all one area. You know, in the lifetime of people like King Hussein and others, Palestine had ceased to exist. So there was a lot of sympathy for Palestinians generally and also for the refugees. But in that short period after 67, the perception that the Palestinian movement had no respect for the existing mode of government or for the government authorities was disrespecting the role of the Jordanian army and others in also defending their homeland from Israel. There were multiple layers of feeling that these Palestinians were upstarts, were disrespectful, wouldn't respect property and the dignity of citizens, etc. And of course, a lot of this was then built on and deliberately amplified in government media to, you know, amplify this image of the Palestinian guerrillas alien or as an urban imposition on, you know, true blood East Bank villagers. There was a lot of very deliberate, of course, propaganda of this sort. But we fundamentally, what did happen was that a significant number of people went from being sympathetic or even actively supporting the movement to becoming at best neutral or passive, if not openly hostile. And I think what was striking was the number of middle-class Palestinians who maybe were not hostile, but who were no longer willing to risk their lives or their property and were not actually willing to stand up against the government or the monarchy in favor of a movement that they felt increasingly alienated from.
After the clashes in Jordanian territory ended with the Palestinian militants, why was Jordanian Prime Minister Wasfi Al-Attal assassinated in Cairo?
The September 1970 battles ended in not quite a draw because the Palestinian movement had been defeated, but nonetheless it wasn't completely defeated. It still had, you know, fairly extensive presence in both in the capital Amman and some of the other cities such as Zarqa, and also in rural areas, mainly to the north and to the west of the capital in the Jordan Valley or in the hills overlooking it. The Jordanian government signed a new peace deal with the PLO that recognized the PLO's right to recruit and to base itself in Jordan, but imposed certain conditions and criteria on this. It banned them from holding heavy weapons inside population areas, population centers. It controlled their movement between areas of Jordan. It tried to regulate their movement, etc. It also called on the disarming or the partial disarming of their home defense militia in the refugee camps, who were required to submit their arms and put them in central depots, which would still be under their control, but no longer have guns in people's homes. There was a compromise that the PLO saw as a setback and as a retreat, but it still maintained a significant presence in the country. And it was in the following summer, in July 1971, that the government launched its final onslaught to eradicate all remaining PLO presence, military for sure, but even civilian in the country, all offices or societies, medical societies, orphanages, whatever, all these were to cease to be official PLO facilities in the country. This onslaught was overseen by the Prime Minister, who was brought in September 1970 at the time of the peace deal, and that was Wasfi Al-Attal, who himself regarded himself as having been a supporter of the liberation of Palestine, as being anti-Israeli, but wanted this to be done under the leadership of the Jordanian government. He nonetheless did the king's work in being the face of the government in dealing with the Palestinian movement. And he was seen as a hawk who was determined to bring the movement to heel and, if necessary, to destroy it in order to ultimately, according to people who knew him at the time, in order to enable a different kind of strategy for the liberation of Palestine. But for the Palestinians, he was the person who had engineered and masterminded the final destruction of their base in Jordan. And so for that, he ultimately paid the price by being assassinated in Cairo a few months later.
And last question, what were the lessons for King Hussein from the civil war?
That's a very interesting question and a fairly tough one. The way in which the king and, of course, other members of the ruling family, in particular Crown Prince Hassan, and the key security establishment of Jordan, the way they thought about things in the years after focused on several parallel tracks. One was to secure the armed forces and the intelligence services from any possible penetration by people who might not be loyal. And what this meant de facto was a policy of limiting the recruitment of people of Palestinian background into the armed forces. Now, this will be denied by Jordanian officers I've spoken to, but then, you know, a lot of anecdotal evidence does seem to suggest that you can't find people who are of prominent Palestinian families in the key combat units such as armor and artillery or special forces, etc. or in the Air Force, for instance, you might find them in the medical services or support services where they don't wield significant, capability for making trouble. Generally speaking, I think he helped create an environment in which at least the middle class felt that they weren't going to be victimized for their past support for the Palestinian movement, and that they could come and go freely, and as long as they didn't engage in secret, clandestine Palestinian activity, then they'd be left pretty much to their own devices. And this allowed a group of moderate nationalist Palestinian politicians to emerge, people who were from the upper middle class, who benefited from this environment, and became what you might call, if you like, loyal opposition. They wanted a more democratic system, but they weren't working to overthrow the monarchy, and the monarchy reciprocated by allowing them to act and speak and form their own circles. So there were a number of different methods in which I think the king showed that he himself had matured, having come to the throne very young and gone through this very bitter test. He ended up trying to emphasize the bonds between Palestinians and Jordanians, even while, of course, making sure that these bonds served his continued rule. All of this laid the basis, I think, for him in the 1980s to start opening up the economy, to restore parliament, and eventually to disconnect Jordan's administrative ties to the West Bank and to acknowledge the PLO as solely representative of Palestinians who are not citizens of Jordan, and also as the party which ultimately should take control of the West Bank, although officially it had been annexed to Jordan. So I think the king, matured in many ways that allowed a reconciliation with the PLO after they were from Lebanon in 1982. And overall, this helped improve ties within the kingdom among different population sectors.
Thank you very much, Dr. Sayah. We really appreciate your time.
My pleasure.
That was Dr. Yazid Sayah. Here's what else you should know this week. On Thursday, Jordan voted for a UN General Assembly resolution calling on Russian forces to leave Ukraine and end the conflict. During the war, Jordan has offered mild support for Ukraine. It has backed multiple UN measures rebuking Moscow, but King Abdullah has declined to publicly criticize Russia for the invasion. Amman has also not provided Ukraine with any military weapons, despite being a key US ally. In contrast to previous years, King Abdullah has also not spoken with either Russian President Vladimir Putin, nor his Ukrainian counterpart Zelensky, since a full-scale war broke out in February 2022. In other news, on February 16th, Jordan News reported the Hashemite Kingdom's population has reached 11.3 million. 20 years ago, Jordan's population was only approximately 5 million. Before I go, please subscribe to the podcast on Apple, Spotify, or Amazon. And please listen to previous episodes on Jordan's relationship with the IMF by economist Leila Ajlouni and the December trucker protest with Balad Radio's Daoud Kutab. Finally, if you're listening to podcasts in Jordan and think you'd be a great guest, or if you have an idea for the podcast, please message me on Twitter at Aaron Magid or via email, aaron.magid1@gmail.com. Thanks for listening.